The Guardian.
Hello, I'm John Dennis, and this is Guardian Weekly for Wednesday, March the 26th. International news and analysis from our team of reporters and commentators. This week, as Zimbabwe goes to the polls, we hear from the journalist who had dinner with Robert Mugabe.
I don't make kids, no. But I just make me an
When he and I talked about the royal family, he was close to tears. I really thought he was going to cry.
Also today, aid agencies accuse the West of breaking their promises to Afghanistan.
It's not so much as the money going anywhere as it's not arriving in the first place.
And why British bobbies are pounding the beat in Calgary in Canada.
People here are very respectful. They are yes sir, no sir. And even people with extensive criminal records aren't abusive to you. They're normally very respectful.
Zimbabwe's election on Saturday is being seen as a referendum on Robert Mugabe's 28 years in power. We'll be hearing shortly from our correspondent in Zimbabwe, but first, what of the president himself? The Zimbabwean journalist Heidi Holland conducted a rare interview with the man in December last year.
What sort of a person are you in a few words? The essence of you?
The essence of me? Well, I feel that I'm just an ordinary person, that I feel within me there is a charitable disposition towards others, just as I find charitable dispositions also towards me from others. And I don't make enemies, no, but others make me an enemy of theirs. In some cases I pity them, really.
So you're not a vengeful person? No. Are you a forgiving person?
Yes, I think so. Otherwise, I would have slaughtered lots of people, including Ian Smith.
What is your vision for Africa?
What would I want? Africa to be completely free, first and foremost. We are not free. Far from it. And just now, this is Africa that is dependent on donors, by and large. Mm. Majority of our countries are funded in the main by donors. Their budgets sustained by same countries that used to be where their colonial masters. And we are not yet really free in the true sense of the word. We've got to translate our political freedom into economic freedom. And as long as we remain producers of primary products, with no capacity, you know, to industrialize, so shall we remain, you know, subservient to our former colonial masters.
Robert Mugabe talking to Heidi Holland, and she joins me now on the line from Johannesburg. Heidi, this was obviously a rare interview with Robert Mugabe. What was your impression of him?
He's very, very still. He's a bit scary because he's so quiet, you know. And when I asked him during the interview why people feared him so much, he said, because I speak very quietly and nobody knows what I'm thinking. So, I mean, it might even be partly deliberate, but he's a very shy man, and I think always was. And when I asked him questions which got close to his concerns, you know, particularly personal questions, his head dropped down as he looked at his hands and his voice became even quieter. It was quite disconcerting. On the tape, I could hardly hear him at times. Not that it was that good a recording, but it was so, so quiet. So I think it's unusual for him to talk about himself. He's got no friends, never had any friends, even as a little boy. Hides behind his intellect, reads books, and always did. And that's the atmosphere he exudes of a really lonely man, and actually today quite a vulnerable man, I thought.
Did the fact that he doesn't do many interviews mean that he was inadvertently revealing about himself?
I had pitched it at the personal level all along. I'd actually said to the priest who set it up for me that I wanted to write about the man behind the monster. I actually used the term monster, which I thought might put everybody off. I kept on finding that the things that I thought would not go down well were okay, and the things I thought were okay were not going down well. So it was quite difficult once I got there to really figure it all out, except that having worked with three psychologists throughout my research, I did have a fairly good idea of what his issues were.
And tell us something, Heidi, about how you secured this interview with Robert Mugabe.
I was intent initially on talking to people who had known Robert Mugabe in some form or another, either as relatives or colleagues during the war. And then once I'd started to collect this disparate information from people as divergent as Lord Soames, for example, or Lord Carrington in England, and Edgar Tekeri and Jonathan Moyo, who are Mugabe's implacable enemies in Zimbabwe, it was then that I hit on the idea of trying to get a deeper understanding of the man via psychologists who could interpret how the external events and events that impacted on him related to him internally, how he received them.
Zimbabwe is obviously facing hyperinflation, mass unemployment, there's not enough food. Is your impression that Robert Mugabe is in denial about these problems?
Definitely, yes. I think it's too painful for him at one level to accept what he's done there. You know, he's a very unrealistic man. He lived a very deprived life. And indeed, he's pretty disconnected from his emotional intelligence anyway. Everything happens in his head. He's very developed at that level, having 7 degrees. But I think he's constructed a world in which he can only be right. And the people around him have to subscribe to that. So people have had to buy into that. And in fact, there's a big banner outside the office of his spokesperson, George Turumba, who's also the man charged with keeping journalists out of the country. And there's a huge banner saying Mugabe is right. And that's inside the presidency. So you have to wonder who needs reminding there.
So Mugabe will be approaching this weekend's elections with a lot of confidence.
Although I did get a strong sense that he saw me because he wanted to put some stuff on the record. He wanted to explain himself, not with a view to forgiveness, but, you know, self-justification. He's very aggrieved. He's done all these things because he really believes he's been wronged. You know, he's a self-pitying man. He's a weak man. He doesn't have the inner strength that would be needed in any form of politics, much less the violent history of Zimbabwe.
And he blames Britain for many of his country's ills.
He does, yes. He particularly blames Britain. And part of that is because he himself identified so closely with Britain all his life. He grew up in a mission station. The priests who taught him, the people that he related to after his father had legged it and abandoned the family, many of them were British. I think in a very real sense, Mugabe is or sees himself partly as British, which is why when he and I talked about the royal family, he was close to tears. I really thought he was going to cry.
And he blames Tony Blair for turning the royal family against him.
Yes. Well, he blames Tony Blair for not honouring the Lancaster House Agreement insofar as he had held out throughout those negotiations for compensation, at least for land, money to redistribute land in Zimbabwe. It was a key issue to him, whatever Clare Short says about that today. And the British withdrew further funding after part of it had been squandered in Zimbabwe. It was squandered, that's true. It wasn't all squandered. But the issue that he wanted to get across in my interview with him was that John Major had cranked up that program again. John Major had put on the table a lot more money, and that's true. And then in came Tony Blair and just wiped it out and said, no, we're a Labour government. We've got nothing to do with Lancaster House, i.e. colonialism, and we're not going to give you any more. And he was absolutely livid about that.
How do you think Robert Mugabe thinks he'll be remembered?
Well, he himself answered that question. He would like to be remembered as a liberator, as a freedom fighter. When you ask him that question, he goes back to the years of his triumph, you know, when he had promise.
Heidi Holland talking to me from Johannesburg. And Heidi's book, Dinner with Mugabe, is published by Penguin. Before we hear the latest on the election from our Africa correspondent Chris McGreal, who's in Zimbabwe, let's find out what Zimbabweans expect to happen.
There's no way that I can even say that these elections will be free and fair, because already we are witnessing the ruling party getting involved in violence and intimidation.
Yeah, I doubt if these elections will be free and fair, because there is this information that the results will be announced after a week.
They find it very hard to believe that he can win majority support when he's overseeing 100,000% inflation, 80% unemployment, nearly half the population is chronically malnourished, and the national currency, the Zimbabwe dollar, has fallen so far that you're now paying billions of dollars and great wads of notes if you're lucky enough to have a job at all. Quite extensive evidence of vote rigging being put in place, padded voters' rolls. Sometimes a quarter of a constituency simply is named of people that simply don't appear to live there. One I came across was pointed out to me by the opposition. is that 8,000 people that live in 36 houses in one Harare constituency. So I think people are expecting the election to be anything but clean and free and fair.
What is President Mugabe saying about the economy?
He says that this is the result of sanctions imposed by the developed countries to punish him and to punish Zimbabwe for taking the land away from white farmers. He says it has nothing to do with his own economic policies and it's entirely foreign sanctions.
Mugabe's 84 now. I mean, in the longer term, do people hope that their lives will improve when he finally does leave office?
A lot of people have hoped that something will change with this election that will at the very least mark the beginning of the end for Mugabe. I think that we've already seen about 3 million Zimbabweans, mostly people of working age, left the country, many of them going to South Africa, other southern African countries, perhaps as many as 500,000 to Britain. And I think that actually there's a sense if he does win again, there will be hope for many of them, and probably we will see the numbers of people leaving this country continue to increase.
But is there any hope at all that his former finance minister, Simba Mokone, can win this time around?
There's only been one sort of reliable opinion poll. That seems to suggest that Mokone is in third place behind Mugabe, and the leading candidate is Morgan Tsvangirai of the Movement for Democratic Change, who probably won the 2002 election, but it was stolen from him. That said, there's little doubt that Mokone has not only invigorated the election, he's divided the ruling ZANU-PF and made Mugabe feel a lot less certain about who he can rely on, and perhaps who he can count on to actually rig the vote in his favour. So I think that whilst it's not clear whether Mokone can win, come in second place and force a runoff against Mugabe, I think what Mokone has done is upset the balance and made it that much more difficult for him to be confident of simply putting the fix in.
Western donors are failing to keep their promises to Afghanistan, according to a new report published by ACBAR, an alliance of 94 international aid agencies, including Oxfam, Christian Aid, Islamic Relief and Save the Children. It says the international community has pledged $25 billion to Afghanistan since 2001, but only $15 billion has been delivered. That's a shortfall of $10 billion, or £5 billion. Matt Waldman is Oxfam's Afghanistan policy advisor, and he's the report's author. Matt, where's the money gone?
Well, it's not so much as the money going anywhere as it not arriving in the first place. I think we should accept that a significant amount of aid has come into Afghanistan, but nowhere near enough to fulfill the very great needs of Afghanistan. I think we need to remember that in 2001, when the international intervention took place, there had been 2.5 decades of war, and this had destroyed almost all of the institutions of the state. An awful lot of aid is required in order to rebuild a country, and that is why what has been delivered is insufficient. It is worth noting, I think, as well, that it is just overall about a tenth of the military spending in Afghanistan, if you look at the volume of spending per day. So I think there's an awful lot's got to be done. We need more aid, and it's got to be better spent.
Your report also says that 40% of the money that has been delivered to Afghanistan has gone on corporate profits and consultancy fees.
Well, part of the explanation for that is that private large contracting companies are involved in the reconstruction process, and that is understandable, it is necessary, but the problem is that they are making very significant profits, and these increase when you have several layers of subcontractors in any given project. So we think there needs to be rigorous analysis and assessment of whether contractors are delivering value for money. We need to have transparency and proper, open and fair procurement and tendering processes. There is also a problem with the consultants who are paid very high salaries, and they have top-ups of sometimes 35% for hardship pay, 35% for danger pay. So you can see a lot of money is going back to donor countries. We think in both cases there's got to be proper assessment of whether these organisations or individuals are providing value for money.
You've just presented your findings to MPs at the House of Commons. What reaction did you get from them?
Well, in fact, we were very pleased to receive the endorsement of all three parties for many of the proposals that we were putting forward. And I think there will be pressure, and I hope that the politicians in the House of Commons and the House of Lords will seek to press for improvements in the delivery of aid in Afghanistan, particularly with their counterparts across the Atlantic and in Europe.
Because some Western countries are better than others at getting the aid through to Afghanistan.
Well, that is true. And for example, the Netherlands is giving a very significant amount of aid. Britain is too. And a lot of that aid goes to supporting the work of government. Other countries, such as France and Spain, have given only scant contributions, totaling only some $100 million, according to the Afghan government. So, yes, I think there are donors that need to pull their weight.
And the biggest donor is the US. How have the Americans fared?
Well, the Americans, of course, are the most generous donor, and that needs to be recognised and appreciated. It's very clear there wouldn't have been the progress without the substantial contribution that has been made by the United States. However, there is a great deal that they could do to increase the fulfilment of their commitment. They have admitted today that they've only delivered some two-thirds of what they promised, and to improve the effectiveness of what they do. Only 6% of their aid goes through the Afghan government, and much of it is tied, which means that there's a requirement for contractors to use goods and services provided by the United States. And of course, that undermines the impact on the Afghan economy.
Matt Waldman from Oxfam, many thanks for talking to us. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Weekly, the Arab League summit in Damascus is snubbed by Egypt and Saudi Arabia in protest at Syria's involvement in Lebanon.
Lebanon, if you like, is a fault line that cuts across the Middle East, and a lot of the conflicts of the region are being played out there.
It may be boring, but even the criminals are polite. Why British police officers are heading for Alberta.
Even people with extensive criminal records aren't abusive to you. They're normally very respectful.
And Bhutan becomes the world's newest democracy with a certain degree of reluctance.
Everybody I've ever spoken to on the ground has said we prefer the king to stay.
But first, joining us in the studio is the editor of the print edition of Guardian Weekly, Natalie Bennett, to tell us what's in this week's edition. Natalie, leading this week with Tibet.
Indeed, we have extensive coverage across a number of pages looking at what's happening with the continuing unrest there, what's happened with the Olympic ceremonies, and we actually go in to visit the Dalai Lama's court and see what's happening there.
And there's a report from a part of the world which I must confess I'd not heard of before. I don't know if any of our listeners are aware of this area. Transnistria. Are you going to enlighten us?
I am indeed. 10 points for anyone who can point it out on a map. What it is actually, it's a breakaway part of Moldova. And we've got a fascinating piece from Le Monde, our sister paper. And what's happening is the Russians are trying to do a deal. They're going to get the Russian-speaking people in Transnistria to go back within Moldova to accept central government. And in return, Moldova will agree not to try to join NATO and agree perpetual neutrality forever. So that's the way the Russians are trying to do this deal.
Now, there's been a lot of coverage on the 40th anniversary of the 1968 revolutions, of course, including at Guardian.co.uk, and a great piece by Tariq Ali, a former revolutionary himself, of course, revisiting the ideals of 1968.
Indeed, you might say there's a little bit of nostalgia here. He trolls through some of the best parts, the most exciting parts, but then he also looks at the question of what it means now. When people like Nicolas Sarkozy are saying that, saying Enron, Conrad Black, the sub-mortgage crisis, Northern Rock, all of this was the fault of 1968, which I think Tariq Ali would question anyway. But he says, what went wrong? Why didn't things turn out like they wanted in 68? He says, revolutionaries wanted the whole forest. Liberals and social democrats were fixated on the trees. So I think what he's saying is we didn't think big enough back then.
So it's all Guardian readers' fault. and in a piece exploring the genetics of cats, Persian cats, not Persian, shocker.
Exactly, that's right. They've been sneaking around and apparently they started out in Western Europe but went off for perhaps for sunnier climes. It's an interesting study looking at the genetics of cats because unlike dogs, they've only been bred for about 200 years and they're much more genetically diverse. I suspect also that cats are rather better at sneaking out and making their own domestic arrangements, whatever the humans would like them to do. So what we're looking at here is how different breeds of cats are related to each other. And as you might expect, cats from Sri Lanka and Singapore, they're a mixture of Asian and European influences as a result of colonialism. So one more thing that you might might be able to blame colonialism for.
Well, many thanks, Natalie. And don't forget, you can subscribe to Guardian Weekly. And if you do so, you'll get 4 free issues. GuardianWeekly.co.uk. The annual Arab League summit takes place this week in Damascus, but a rift over Lebanon threatens to overshadow the meeting. Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah and his foreign minister are staying away. The Egyptian president, Hosni Mubarak, is also not expected to attend. Well, Ian Black is The Guardian's Middle East editor, and he's on the line. Ian, Syria's being blamed for effectively blocking the election of a new Lebanese president.
Well, that's right. This is a crisis that's been going on for some months now. The mandate of the previous Lebanese president, who was a Syrian-backed appointee, expired last November. And since then, despite a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and Arab diplomacy, it's proved impossible to fill the post. And that's basically because Lebanon is fundamentally divided, and Syria is siding with the opposition, and they've been blocking the election of a new president. That's the immediate cause, if you like, of the tension over the summit, and as you've said, with some very high-profile, very important Arab leaders, particularly the King of Saudi Arabia and almost certainly President Mubarak of Egypt, staying away in protest. There is great polarization in the Arab world. It's the Syrians' turn to host this summit. It's a regular event, and the leaders are voting with their feet, if you like, and saying, we're not taking part in this. We don't want to give legitimacy to Syria at a time when it's on the wrong side of many of the conflicts that we're dealing with in this region.
Isn't this a bit of an own goal for Syria, though? I mean, it's hosting this summit, and then, as you say, there are high-profile absentees.
Well, you know, summits are part of the landscape, just as they are in Europe, in the Arab world, the Arab League that represents all Arab states, there's a degree of prestige attached to them. But, of course, they also reflect the current state of politics and of divisions. And the significant thing about Syria, I think, is not only does it play a very dominant role in Lebanon next door, and has been seen to be blocking progress towards finding a way out of the deadlock there, but it's also seen to be on the wrong side of the argument on other issues too. Syria is the only Arab country that has a close relationship with Iran. Both of those support the radical movements in the Arab world, Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas and other Islamist groups in the Palestinian territories fighting Israel. The majority of the leadership in the Arab world are basically pro-Western, pragmatic. They want to see these problems resolved. But, of course, they're not making much progress. The Palestinian issue is in a state of dangerous deadlock, as ever. Lebanon is potentially very unstable. There is this divide, if you like, in the Arab world between the Shia world, dominated by the Iranians, of course, who aren't Arabs, but with the groups that they're supporting. And, of course, in the background, you have this disaster of Iraq, and everything is chaos. That's the background to a summit which is going to be very divisive, and there will be some embarrassment, certainly, for the Syrians who are hosting it, but they're also defiant. They're holding to their own positions as well.
What's the prospect of an end to the political deadlock in Lebanon?
Well, not good. Parliament has just postponed, I think for the 17th time, a meeting to elect a new president. The deadlock cannot be broken. It reflects this fundamental division in the country between, on the one hand, a large part of the Christian community and some of the Sunni Muslims and the Druze, a government that is backed by the West, and an opposition, the dominant part of which is Hezbollah, the Lebanese Islamist movement, with some Christian allies, backed by Syria, the Iranians. And Lebanon, if you like, is a fault line that cuts across the Middle East, and a lot of the conflicts of the region are being played out there. So it's not really surprising that it's Lebanon. The stalemate there has created the barrier to, you know, a successful summit where everybody would attend and say everything's fine and dandy in the Arab world. It very patently isn't, and that's why this is going to be a rather unsuccessful event, I think.
And how much authority does the Arab League have?
Well, yeah, the Arab League is really just governments working together. Not like the European Union, for example, a very successful regional organization where European governments have agreed to pool some of their powers and sovereignty to do things together. The Arab League is governments acting together, and when they don't agree, not much happens. And so for all the goodwill and for all the aspiration to solve the serious problems, if another member state isn't going to play ball, and that's the case with the Syrians, then it ain't going to happen. So that's why we're seeing this event taking place at a time of paralysis and tension and great disputation, if you like, across the region.
Ian, many thanks. The United Nations has warned that the people of the Ogaden Desert in eastern Ethiopia face famine because of a conflict between Somali rebels and the Ethiopian federal government. The Ogaden National Liberation Front is one of the world's most dangerous and most misunderstood insurgencies. The Guardian's Simon Tisdall has just returned from the area, the regional capital Jijiga, and is on the line now. Simon, who are the Ogaden National Liberation Front and what do they want?
They're members mostly of the Ogadeni clan, which people the three sort of easternmost provinces of Ethiopia bordering Somalia. They're mostly ethnic Somalis, mostly Muslim. And what they actually want is not clear. They're often referred to as a separatist movement, but it may be they want to fulfill the historic dream of a greater Somalia, linking parts of Ethiopia with Somalia. Maybe they want independence, or maybe they just want autonomy. It's not clear.
And there have been some regional clans fighting with the ONLF and others fighting alongside the Ethiopian army in the region.
That appears to be the case. It's a much more complicated situation than has previously been reported in the Western press, where comparisons rather ill-founded, in fact extremely ill-founded, have been made with what's been going on in Darfur in Western Sudan. The claims by the ONLF, which is mostly run from the diaspora, that is Ethiopian ethnic Somalis living abroad, have been talking about a genocide and a campaign of great atrocities and brutality by the Ethiopian army. There has been a lot of fighting in the region in the last 9 months or so, although it's died down a bit lately, but it's not as bad as they've been making out.
So how much credence should we give to these claims that the Ethiopian troops have been carrying out human rights abuses and genocide?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I mean, Human Rights Watch has been very strident on this, normally quite reliable, but they're saying that there has been a series of actions that would appear to be war crimes. The Ethiopian government adamantly denies that. They say that they have not been carrying out those kind of clearances of villages and so on that have been reported. Nearly everything that comes out of that region is hearsay or second or third hand. Until I went there with a group of reporters from Addis Ababa, there'd been no Western reporters in the area for 9 months. And what's more, the aid agencies and NGOs and the UN had been excluded from some of the combat zones for a while. So no one really knew what was going on, and it's still extremely hard to tell because people are frightened, both of what the authorities might do if they said things they didn't like, but also of the ONLF, who have reportedly undertaken reprisals against villagers and so on who don't help them.
And the UN's now warning of possible famine in the region.
Well, that underlies the whole problem there. This is an extremely impoverished area of the world, extremely inaccessible. It's ironically potentially quite wealthy. There may be oil there. Chinese state company has been exploring for oil in the Ogaden for a couple of years now, but at the moment it's a very inaccessible, very poor region. There has been a failure of rainfall in the last few months, which has led the UN to say that there may be a crop failure, there may be a serious drought famine emergency in the making.
Is there an end in sight to the conflict?
Not really, as far as I can see, because the ONLF is an extremely miasmic type group. It's not clear who they represent. As in other parts of East Africa, they may actually just be largely bandit-type individuals and unemployed and malcontents who don't really have a political base at all. The situation in terms of the clans is extremely difficult because there's a long history of feuds between sub-clans and other sub-clans, some of which side with the authorities and some with the opposition at a given time, but then the situation changes depending on who gets what. And it's not as though you can go to a place in the Ogaden and talk to an ONLF commander at his base. There's no such thing.
Simon, many thanks.
Thank you.
We are switching our system of monarchy, with which we have so much of faith and trust, to moving into a system to which we hope it will be good, but yet on the other hand, we are going with a sense of apprehension as to how it will turn out to be.
This is my first election. I feel very proud, and I'm looking for a new government which will serve people very best.
We are hoping some changes will come. A lot of developments will be taking place in our country. But overall, we love our king, and he will be above us, looking on all the activities.
The last independent Himalayan kingdom, Bhutan, lies between India and China and has just had its first taste of democracy. In its first ever parliamentary election, voters rejected the party led by the King of Bhutan's uncle. They voted instead for the Bhutan United Party, led by Jigme Thinley, a former prime minister. Well, Randeep Ramesh is the Guardian's South Asia correspondent and he's on the line now. Randeep, this was a shock result.
I think it was, yeah. Most people had sort of predicted it would be a very tight race, especially the two leaders of the party had both been previous prime ministers. And Bhutan is, by its very nature, a very paternalistic state, and no one thought that there'd be such a massive surge for one side or the other. Having said that, the winner, Mr. Jigme Thinley, is always seen as a very clever politician. He had worn both the clothes of a moderniser, heavily involved in economic planning, and a canny diplomat. He had represented Bhutan at the United Nations, and he played his hand very well. He positioned himself as a grassroots politician against the in-laws of the king.
And he's been elected not just on a platform of improving the economy, but also the country's gross national happiness.
Yeah, gross national happiness is Bhutan's most famous cultural export. It's a measure not just of a country's economic growth, but other factors. And they do it by series of opinion polls, really. And it's found a lot of favour with economists recently. I mean, Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner, has been on the record saying, you know, there's more to life than growth. I mean, everybody's looking for that intangible way of measuring a country's rise that isn't just related to material progress.
How did Bhutan go from being a hereditary monarchy to a modern democracy?
Well, actually, the seeds of this were planted by the Chinese invasion of Tibet in 1959, because until then you had a series of Himalayan independent kingdoms. You had Mustang in Nepal, you had Sikkim in what has now become India, you had Tibet in what is now China, and Bhutan was another one of these kingdoms. Ladakh on the other end of the eastern Himalayas is another one of those places. But one by one, they got swallowed up by bigger, larger, multinational, multi-ethnic states, India, China, Nepal. And Bhutan saw itself very much as the last repository of independent Buddhism, Himalayan Buddhism. And since the early 60s, the monarchs of the Wangchuck dynasty have gradually been unwinding their country's feudal structure, doing so very slowly and very carefully. I think the only blot in that process has been the expulsion of Nepali speakers, and that's related again to India's takeover of neighbouring Sikkim state, where Nepali speakers rose up in uprising, demanded democracy, and by simple weight of demographics took over the country and handed it to India. And I think Bhutan never wanted that to happen to them, either being swallowed by China or swallowed by India.
The people of Bhutan, you know, what do they think? Have they embraced democracy? Do they enjoy this election campaign?
Well, certainly the opinion formers have. The newspaper columnists, the editors and the bureaucrats, they've all enjoyed the campaign. But I can't say I've met an ordinary Bhutanese person who's really kind of vigorously advocated the case for democracy. Almost everybody I've ever spoken to on the ground has said we prefer the king to stay. So I think it was great reluctance they went to the polls, although they did surprisingly turn out in rather large numbers. You know, there is another side to the Bhutan story, which if you speak to long-time observers of Bhutan, they refer to it in almost Singaporean terms. And this outcome is rather like what happens in Singapore, where there is an opposition and there is one ruling party, but the ruling party always stays in power. And here something similar has happened. I just think there's an enormous amount of conformism in Bhutanese society. And it seemed to me if they were going to go one way, they would really plump for it. And I think that's what happened here.
And what will be the role of the king now?
Well, the king remains the head of state, and he is probably still an all-powerful member of any cabinet. Although he's a constitutional monarch who can be evicted by the parliament, it's unlikely that he ever would be. In fact, I think there would probably be an uprising, a monarchist uprising, if that were the case.
Randy, many thanks. The police force in Calgary in Canada faces a labour shortage. With that in mind, it's been trying to tempt British coppers across the Atlantic. With the promise of a lower crime rate and a good standard of living, Helen Pidd went to Alberta in Calgary to meet some of the new recruits.
Hi, I'm Stuart O'Neill, recruiting constable with the Calgary Police Service. Used to be with the City of London Police for 10 years as a detective constable.
And what was your motivation? You know, you'd been a long-serving police officer in the UK. Why did you come over here?
Just improve the quality of life for my family. I've got a wife and two kiddies, so the opportunities here are far greater than back home.
And why is the Calgary Police Force looking abroad, and particularly to Britain, for new officers? Why is there such a shortage here?
Well, Alberta is experiencing a boom right now with regard to the oil industry. So a lot of guys that Calgary Police would have traditionally hired are going up to work in the oil industry, where they get paid very well. Calgary Police has a lot of guys retiring. The boomers are retiring. So the City Council, for the last 2 or 3 years, have given us additional numbers. You know, there's less people applying locally. So I'm one of about 20 or so British officers that were here anyway. We seem to do a good job for them in Calgary, and the management decided to go and try and entice more Brits across to Calgary.
But what are the cultural differences between the way of policing here and in Britain?
Well, culturally it's reasonably similar. There are language barriers. You know, we think we speak English, but we don't always speak Calgarian English properly. One of my colleagues went to an accident and explained that the lady had a small dink in the rear. That has a different meaning here compared to back home.
What does dink mean?
Well, a dink here would be described as perhaps an idiot. So when he came on the air and said, yes, she has a small dink in the rear, it made the dispatcher burst into laughter.
So I am out on patrol with Ross Harper. He's been here since 2004, ex-military man of 8 years. He worked in North Yorkshire. We've just come into McDonald's. They've apparently got some problems here, people hanging around, drug deals. He's just talking to a homeless guy who has a cardboard sign. He's begging in McDonald's.
I warned you yesterday, didn't I?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to warn you again, Larry, okay? Panhandling from vehicles is an offence. I will issue you a ticket if I catch you doing it again.
What struck me when you were just talking to him there is that he did seem jolly respectful for a guy who's always in trouble with the police.
People I deal with in my walk of life here, normally it's yes or no, sir, and I respond in the same. I treat people with respect, and if they don't respect me back, then they dictate the way the conversation's going to go. People here are very respectful. They are yes sir, no sir, and even people with extensive criminal records aren't abusive to you. They're normally very respectful.
Mm-hmm.
I've had people tell me if they're wanted before I've even started checking them. So.
And that wouldn't happen in the UK?
Normally I'd be running after them down the street at that point, and at that point I realise they're wanted when they're about 100 metres away down the street. So normally in the UK, when I was talking to someone, I'd try and have a hand on something so they didn't run away on me. Here, I've only ever had one guy run away from me in 4 years.
Helen Pidd reporting from Alberta in Calgary. Guardian Weekly's producer is Matt Hayward. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.